Welcome to the Healthful Woman Podcast, the fastest growing podcast in women's health. Today's Monday, April 8th, 2024. Today we have a mailbag podcast, number 8, What Does the Fox Say? Questions today come from our listeners, Caroline, Grace, Jennifer, my niece, Sarah, Penny, and Jordan. Topics today include nitrous oxide in labor, false positive NIPT, having your tubes removed, how long to wait to conceive after a cesarean, screening for diabetes, and screening for hypothyroid and anemia in pregnancy. Lots of great topics. If any of you have questions you'd like me to cover in future mailbag podcasts, please send them along. You can either email us directly at hw@healthfulwoman.com or go to our website, www.healthfulwoman.com, and click on the link that says send us your questions. Please remember, these questions are for mailbag podcasts, not your own personal medical advice that you might need answered quickly. If you have questions that you do need answered quickly, please ask your own doctor. All right, I have a couple of really cool announcements. First, I wanted to give a huge shout out to my wife, Michal, who donated a kidney last week to an anonymous recipient through the organization Renewal. Thank God the surgery went well. Yes, I am married to a very wonderful woman. Amazing act of kindness. We should all be inspired to think of others like she does. Thanks to all of you who sent in well wishes after seeing my Instagram video last week about this. All of them are very much appreciated. Second announcement. As you all know, the book that Emily Oster and I wrote, The Unexpected, is being released in a few weeks. We're very excited about that. And I finally have information on a book signing event. This one is in New York City on May 22nd at 7 p.m. at the JCC of the Upper West Side of Manhattan. There's going to be an event and book signing. My understanding is it is going to be a conversation with Emily and me, followed by a book signing. If you go to the JCC's website, it might say a conversation with Emily Oster, but I will be there too. So feel free to sign up for that. I believe that the admission fee comes with a copy of the book. You can check their website for more details. Second, there's going to be a book signing in Washington, D.C. in May at the Politics and Prose Bookstore. Not certain if I'm going to be there or just Emily, but you can stay tuned for more details about that one, and I will send all book signing details that I know about. I'll send them along to you guys. All right. Thanks for listening. See y'all next week.
Welcome to today's episode of Healthful Woman, a podcast designed to explore topics in women's health at all stages of life. I'm your host, Dr. Nathan Fox, an OBGYN and maternal fetal medicine specialist practicing in New York City. At Healthful Woman, I speak with leaders in the field to help you learn more about women's health, pregnancy, and wellness. All right, welcome to our 8th mailbag podcast, What Does the Fox Say? All right, let's jump right into it. Great questions this week. First question from Caroline. Hi, Dr. Fox. Your podcast is exceptional. I am a practicing midwife in Brooklyn, working in a very busy and full scope, arguably high risk private practice. I'm curious if you would consider doing an episode about the use of nitrous oxide in labor and delivery. I witnessed its use during a clinical rotation in the UK, and we are currently piloting it at the hospital I deliver at. Thanks again. All right, great question. So nitrous oxide is also known as laughing gas. It's a type of anesthesia or analgesia or something that relieves pain that is inhaled, right? You breathe it in. It's frequently used in dental procedures, for example. In terms of labor and delivery, it's used a lot in England, in Scandinavian countries, Australia, New Zealand. It's really not used that much in the US. Not exactly sure why, but it just happens to be that that's the case. In terms of using it in labor and delivery, there's a lot of benefits. First of all, it's safe, right? The gas is safe for the mother and for the baby. It's self-administered, meaning what happens is, like, if you go to the dentist frequently, they'll put it on until you fall asleep. But the way it works in labor and delivery is the mother gets to hold the mask herself and put it up to her face when she wants to breathe in the nitrous oxide. And when she doesn't, she takes the mask away from her face. And if she got so much that she would get woozy or pass out, then her hand and the mask would drop away from her face and it wears off within a minute. And so basically she would, you know, wake right back up. So it's not attached to someone's face such that it's always giving medication. It's really up to the mother. She takes it when she wants it. So that's an advantage that it's safe. She can decide for herself when you want it, when you need it. The difficult part of using it in labor is twofold. Number one, it takes about 30 to 60 seconds to fully kick in. And so if you start taking it at the peak of a contraction, by the time it kicks in, the contraction's probably already on its way down. So there is some sort of finesse of timing to either do it the second the contraction starts or try to predict when the contraction is going to start to take it. The other downside, again, it's not a bad thing, but downside is it's not as effective as something like an epidural. So it's a really good option if someone wants some pain relief in labor, but maybe not as much that will be provided by an epidural, or they want it but want to have their mobility, which an epidural doesn't really provide. So it is definitely an option in labor and delivery. I think it's something that will continue to grow in the US for people who don't want an epidural. There's actually now a lot of people using it in the office setting. And spoiler alert, we're actually starting to use it in our office. We just are piloting it right now for office procedures. So that's something that's going to be available in our office. And I think that's definitely also a wave of the future. All right, great question. Next question is from Grace. Thank you for this podcast. It was very helpful. Is it possible to get a positive result for monosomy X from NIPT, but end up being negative for an abnormality in both the placenta and the baby? All right, so a little bit of background. So NIPT, which stands for non-invasive prenatal testing, is essentially what we do nowadays, or what many people do nowadays, to screen for genetic abnormalities in the fetus during pregnancy. And essentially what it is, it's a blood test that's taken from the mother, right, at around 9, 10, 11, 12 weeks of pregnancy. So it's drawn from her arm. And the blood goes to the lab. And what the lab can do is there's always pieces of DNA that are in the mother's blood. They're floating around. And you can see these and you can separate them. You can find them. About 90 to 95% of that DNA is the mother's DNA, which makes sense. It's her blood. There may be, you know, DNA floating around. But about 5 to 10% is actually DNA that comes from the baby, or more specifically from the placenta. As the placenta breaks down, those cells release the DNA and it can go into the maternal circulation. And the lab is able to use the DNA from the baby versus the mother to screen for many genetic conditions or several genetic conditions in the fetus. Now, the perfect screening test would be every time the blood test says baby is normal, the baby's normal. And every time the blood test says the baby's abnormal, the baby's abnormal. That would be like 100% accurate. But that's not how it is. It's highly accurate. It's very, very accurate, but it's not 100%. And there is something called a false positive, where you get a positive, which is actually abnormal, not like positive good, but positive like, as opposed to a negative test. And we try to confuse people in medicine. So negative is good, positive is bad. So you get a positive test that's actually not true. That's why it's a screening test. And it's definitely possible, right, to get a positive test on the NIPT and it not be true. There are ways to figure out what is the likelihood that this result is true versus not true. There's tables and it's based on exactly what is the abnormality, what is your age, there's all these factors that go into it. But basically, why would there be an abnormal test if there's nothing wrong with the baby? So one reason is that, again, since the DNA comes from the placenta and not from the baby, there are times when there's abnormal DNA in the placenta that's not in the baby, right? Typically, the DNA in the baby and the placenta are the same, and that's what it's like in most, if not almost all pregnancies. But every now and again, there's abnormal DNA in the placenta. It can be mosaicism or something abnormal in the placenta that's not in the baby. So it could be that the test is 100% correct, that there's abnormal DNA in the mother's blood, but it's not the DNA that's actually in the baby. And so that's one reason you can do that. Now, this particular question from Grace was saying, well, is there a way to have a false positive result where there's abnormal DNA that's not in the baby or in the placenta? And the answer is yes, that can happen as well. Sometimes there is a pregnancy that looks like a singleton pregnancy, but in fact, there was a second twin that demised very early. So maybe you don't know it. Maybe you didn't see it on ultrasound, but there's abnormal DNA floating around from that second twin that, again, not necessarily known by anybody, but it could be there. There's also rare instances where the abnormal DNA is actually the mother's and not the baby's, something that was unknown. Like sometimes the mothers themselves have a very low line of what's called mosaicism, where most of their DNA is normal. And occasionally there's a few that are abnormal. It's rare, but that can happen. And then there's also chance. The lab is not, these tests are not perfect. And so there's always a chance that someone's, like, the amount of what they're looking for is over the abnormal line, but it's just still normal. And that can happen in a lot of tests. So the answer, Grace, is yes, you can absolutely have a positive result on the NIPT that does not reflect an abnormal baby and also does not reflect an abnormal placenta. All right. Next question is from Jennifer. If the fallopian tubes were removed as a means of permanent sterilization, is there ever a chance they could regenerate? Short answer, no. Long answer. Okay. One of the options for contraception or birth control is having the fallopian tubes of the mother either tied or removed. This is something that we call permanent sterilization, permanent as opposed to temporary. So temporary would be something like condoms, a pill, right? So they're only effective while you're using them. And when you stop, not effective. An IUD is long acting, meaning it can be in for years, but it's still technically temporary because it can be removed. But if you do something like a surgical procedure, so in a male, a vasectomy, for example, is permanent. And in a female, removing the tubes or tying the tubes is called permanent. Now, these types of sterilization can fail. They're highly effective, as you would imagine, but they can fail. With tubes, most of the data on failure, meaning getting pregnant after having this done, is from people who had their tubes, what we call tied, which is either they were like ligated with some sort of a clip that sort of squeezes the middle of them, or sometimes a portion of the tube is removed. We call it a partial salpingectomy. There's different ways to do that procedure. And yes, there is a failure rate for those procedures, but it's very low. It's 1% or less, but it is possible to get pregnant after one of those procedures. If you have the tubes removed entirely, right, anatomically, it should never fail, right? Someone should never get pregnant if the fallopian tube is absent, because there's really no way for the egg that's leaving the ovary to get into the uterus because there's no connection whatsoever. I suppose that there is, in theory, a possibility of failure, but that's probably if maybe the tube wasn't actually completely removed, or maybe the surgeon thought they removed the tube, but maybe they removed something else. You know, these are obviously very, very unusual, but I'm just thinking hypothetically, how could it possibly fail? So that's sort of one thing, but the tubes don't grow back, right? If they're removed, they're gone. It's like if you remove your appendix, right? If you have it taken out, you're not going to grow a new one. That's not something that regenerates. Why would someone have their tubes removed versus tied? There's actually a lot of data on this. One of the reasons is, again, trying to make it more effective, so you have a lower chance of failure. And there's also recent data that removing the tubes entirely actually lowers the risk of certain cancers later in life, most notably ovarian cancer. And so that's something that's discussed with people if they're having their tubes tied for sort of contraception reasons, or if, let's say, they're doing a C-section and want their tubes tied, there's usually discussion that says, well, would you like them tied versus removed? Here's the risks, here's the benefits. And one of the benefits that comes up is it can lower your chance of getting cancer later in life, specifically ovarian cancer. Okay. Next question from Sarah. Hi, Nady. All right. This is a clue that this person knows me. I know I could just text you. There's another clue, but I think this is a basic question that could benefit others. Probably worth mentioning. I'm your niece for the benefit of the listeners. Hello, Sarah, my niece. Thank you for emailing in a question. Thank you for telling me you emailed in a question. Hope you're doing well. Love to the family. All right. Here is Sarah's question. What is the amount of time recommended to wait to conceive after having a C-section, and why? Different doctors are saying different things, from 6 months to 2 years, so I'm confused. Also, a little more broad here, but how does having a C-section affect a future pregnancy/birth? Feel free to use details of the circumstance of my C-section birth if relevant. Thanks, and thank you for your amazing podcast. All right, Sarah, thank you very much. So let's start with the first part of the question about how long should somebody wait after having a C-section to conceive? So there is a reason that there's a lot of confusion around this question. And it is true that there's absolutely different things that people hear. One of the reasons is that the definition is confusing. So for example, if you look at some research studies, how do they define the interval between one pregnancy and the next? So one way to do it is if you take the date your first baby is born and the date your second baby is born, that's the difference. So if I have a baby born January 1st, 2024 and another baby January 1st, 2026, we call it a 2-year interval. So that's one way to define it. But another way to define it is from the date of delivery until the date you conceive. So for example, if I have the same situation where January 1st, 2024, a baby is born and January 1st, 2026, a baby is born, so they're 2 years apart, but the second pregnancy's conception is going to be sometime around, let's say, March of 2025, I guess. So that's 15 months, right? So what do you, or whatever it is, 13 months. So what do you, 12 months. So what do you call it, right? And I think that's part of the reason. Some studies look at the difference between births. Some studies look at the difference between delivering and conception. And so sometimes people are actually saying the same thing. So for example, if one person hears, you know, it should be 6 months and another person hears it should be 18 months, they may actually be referring to the same thing. One person might be saying 6 months until you get pregnant, and the other person might be saying 18 months until you have the next baby. And those are pretty similar. It's probably 6 and 15 to 16, but you get the point. They're pretty similar. So the first thing is to try to be very clear when we're telling patients our recommendations and when we're doing studies and when people are asking, what are we talking about, right? Is it the time from delivery to conception or the time from delivery until the next delivery? So that's confusion number one and why some people hear different things or read different things. The second reason there's confusion is that the data about what is optimal is very limited. And the reason it's limited is it's very hard to sort of do a controlled study, right? A controlled study would be, I take, let's say, you know, 1,000 women who just had a baby and I tell 500 of them, I have to randomly choose 500 and say, you get pregnant in 4 months. And I tell the next 500, you wait 12 months and then get pregnant, right? That's not going to happen. It's not practical. Even if you tell people something, that doesn't really affect when they're actually going to get pregnant, right? Because sometimes it takes longer, sometimes people get pregnant sooner. So you can't do a study like that. So what ends up happening is you sort of have to look backwards at who got pregnant early and who got pregnant later. And if you see a difference between, let's say the women who got pregnant early had some worse outcomes compared to the women who got pregnant later, you never really know, is it because they got pregnant early, meaning something about the uterus not healing, the body not healing, not enough nutrients, you know, something like that? Or is it just there's something about women on average who get pregnant earlier that might be different from women who get pregnant later? For example, let's say access to medical care, access to birth control, or maybe, you know, going back to work, not going back to work, having, you know, nursing, not nursing, right? There's all these variables that could affect possibly when someone gets pregnant that could also affect maybe the outcome. And so if we see differences, we don't know what we're finding. And there have been some actually pretty sophisticated studies that have looked at this. When you look at the less sophisticated studies, what seems to come out is that if you get pregnant, and we haven't even talked about C-section yet, this is just in general, if you get pregnant within 6 months of a birth, right? So you have a birth and then you conceive less than 6 months later, it seems to be that there's an increased risk of a lot of pregnancy complications like preterm birth or the baby not growing well. And that's sort of where this came from, that said you should wait at least 6 months to conceive from one baby to conceiving the next. However, those studies, again, as we were talking about, are somewhat flawed. The more sophisticated studies where they looked, let's say, within a family, said, all right, we're only going to look at women who have 3 children and the interval between babies 1 and 2 was something and between 2 and 3 was something else. And when they did that, right? Because it's the same woman, so all the risk factors are the same. They actually didn't see a real difference between sort of a short interpregnancy interval and a longer one. So it's possible that there's actually no risk pregnancy-wise about getting pregnant early. The typical recommendation is to wait at least 6 months, but the data supporting that, as I've gone over, is pretty weak or limited, is what I would say. Now, when you have a cesarean, there is an extra concern that's on top of all the other concerns about getting pregnant early. And that is, will the scar in the uterus from the C-section have enough time to heal completely prior to the next pregnancy, specifically related to if someone wants to labor and VBAC in the second pregnancy, will the scar have had enough time to heal in order to make it strong enough so that there is not a uterine rupture in the second pregnancy during labor? And so there are data that the chance of a uterine rupture is higher in a second pregnancy in women who get pregnant less than 6 months after the first C-section, which would sort of translate to, you know, whatever, 15 to 17 months between babies. And that's sort of where I think people say at least 18 months. So the data suggests that if you have a C-section, you should wait at least 6 months before conceiving, or try to time your babies about 18 months apart, which is, you know, waiting 7, 8, 9 months, give or take, after having a baby. It's hard to be more precise than that, because again, these studies are not perfect. They are limited. It's not like if someone gets pregnant less than 6 months, they're going to have a uterine rupture. It just, in those studies, the chance of a uterine rupture, instead of being 1%, was like 2% or 2 to 3%. Again, hard to know how much of that is definitively because the scar didn't have enough time to heal, although there is, it's plausible. Also, most people aren't trying to get pregnant within the first 6 months of having a newborn, so it doesn't come up that often. But that's the general advice. After a C-section, wait at least 6 months before trying to conceive. Whether it's helpful to wait longer than 6 months, like waiting 12 months, which some people say, or 18 months, which some people say, it's, the data is not as clear on that in terms of risk of uterine rupture. So I tell people at least 6 months. And if they're trying for a VBAC, maybe they want to wait a little bit longer, like, you know, 6 months to a year or something like that. But it's hard to be very precise other than saying probably 6 months or more is the way to go. Sarah, in terms of the second part of your question, how will it affect a future pregnancy or birth? Other than the issues surrounding VBAC, probably not much. There are some studies that suggest that some things might be slightly increased risk in a pregnancy after a C-section compared to after a vaginal delivery. But again, it's not entirely clear if that's due to the C-section specifically or risk factors for a C-section, which may also be risk factors for pregnancy outcomes. So if someone had a prior C-section, the main focus in terms of the next pregnancy and risk that's different than if they had a vaginal birth is almost always or almost entirely surrounding the issue of labor, VBAC, uterine rupture, things like that. Again, it's not high risk, but that's the risk we're talking about and not so much in terms of the pregnancy itself. All right, Sarah, thank you for the question. Thanks for being a great niece. All right, next question is from Penny, who is not a niece of mine. Hi, Dr. Fox. Why are women required to drink twice as much glucose for the 3-hour glucose tolerance test as for the 1-hour screening test? Couldn't scientists slash labs develop adjusted target blood sugar levels for the 3-hour samples if you were only drinking 50 grams of glucose? Thanks. From a patient who did 2 weeks of finger sticks because I couldn't keep 100 grams of glucose down. All right, Penny, great question. In terms of screening for diabetes in pregnancy, for gestational diabetes, part of the issue is we're using studies that used certain screening tests, right? So if someone did do a large study and looked at a 3-hour test after 50 grams of glucose, maybe would have that, but I'm not familiar with that. Part of it is probably because 50 grams of glucose is a lot, but not that much. And so you may not get as much information about, you know, 2 or 3 hours after you take it as when you take more. Now, it's interesting that there are two main screening tests that are done for diabetes and pregnancy. One is the one you mentioned, which is a two-step process. Step number one is you take a 50-gram drink of glucose, and then 1 hour later, you get your blood drawn. And that's sort of like you get a normal or abnormal, and then if you test normal, you're done. If you test abnormal or a positive test, you go on to the next phase, which is a 100-gram test like you were talking about, but it's actually four blood draws. You come in fasting. You have your blood drawn when you're fasting. Then you drink the 100 grams of glucose and then have your blood drawn 1 hour, 2 hours, 3 hours later. And then typically, if two of those four values are abnormal, you get diagnosed with gestational diabetes. And if less than two, you don't get diagnosed with it. That's typically how it goes. There are some exceptions, but that's typical. There's another way, which is actually 75 grams. So in between 50 and 100, and that is two blood draws. You come in fasting and get your blood drawn. Then you take 75 grams and then 2 hours later, you get your blood drawn. And then you have those two. And again, there's certain criteria for which of the two and how high they have to be considered having gestational diabetes. There is a lot of debate of which of those two screening paradigms is better. It seems to be that the first one is a little bit more annoying because it's two steps and has 100 grams. But the second one is more likely to diagnose gestational diabetes, which may be a good thing, may be a bad thing, but it does not seem to improve outcomes overall. And so people believe maybe it's not a good thing to diagnose it in so many people. All of this is difficult stuff because, again, the data is from studies that use absolute cutoffs, but sugar and sugar levels are not absolute cutoffs. The higher it is, the worse it is potentially. And so it isn't easy. I don't think that they're going to be able to get a good enough test with just 50 grams. That's my guess. 100 seems to work. 75 seems to be okay. So if someone can't tolerate 100, maybe they could tolerate 75. And like you said, for people who just can't tolerate the drink, which absolutely happens from time to time, we're sort of left with no great options. There are sort of certain options for taking things like jelly beans that have a fixed amount of glucose, but it's not as easy as you would think. Or to just do your finger sticks for a couple of weeks and see what they are. It's not a perfect test either, but it's basically the best that we seem to have. Sorry you couldn't keep the drink down. Great question. All right. The next question, two questions, is from Jordan. All right. Jordan from Dallas here. I'm here from the toast and I love the pod. I'm interested in hearing a discussion of blood work you recommend for women, even though it might not be routine. In February 21, I lost a pregnancy likely because of hypothyroidism. Even though I see a primary care provider and OB regularly, no doctor ever checked my T4 and TSH, those are thyroid tests, until I miscarried. Lo and behold, I have hypothyroidism that is now treated. Following that, I tried for 2 years to get pregnant and was unsuccessful until I learned from a hematologist that I was drastically iron deficient. After two iron infusions, I was pregnant within 2 months. I now have a healthy 9-week-old. Yay! I always have wondered how my journey to motherhood would have been different if I'd had a clearer picture of my health and made adjustments accordingly. Thank you. Jordan, thank you for the question about hypothyroid and about anemia. I am very happy to hear about your healthy baby. So it's interesting because as far as we know, having hypothyroid, unless it's profound, right? It's just a mild form of hypothyroid, actually does not seem to increase the risk of infertility or miscarriages. Now, obviously, I can't speak to your specifics, your particulars, without knowing the numbers and your other health and this and that. But in general, it does not appear that people who have mild thyroid abnormalities have an increased risk of miscarriage. The data on that is pretty weak. The main reason that people debate whether to screen everybody in pregnancy for a thyroid issue, which is, again, like you said, checking a TSH, a thyroid stimulating hormone, or a TSH plus a T4, is actually related to a concern, a potential concern that having low thyroid, hypothyroid, could affect the neurodevelopment of the baby. That's sort of where that came into play, and that was the thought. Now, severe thyroid abnormalities can do that, but those are very rare. Mild thyroid abnormalities, like a mild hypothyroidism, which is what most people get diagnosed have, it was thought that by screening for it and treating that, you're going to lower the risk
of neurodevelopmental problems in the babies. And so that's why it was done. But actually, there have been very, very large studies, well-designed studies, where they randomized people to get their thyroid checked and, you know, fix, quote unquote, if there's a mild abnormality versus not checking it at all. And they followed these babies out to like age five. Like it wasn't, you know, this is a big study and there was no difference. And so the current recommendations are not to check thyroid routinely in pregnant women, but only to check it in people who are higher risk for thyroid abnormalities, you know, other medical conditions potentially, or have symptoms of thyroid abnormalities, but not to do it routinely. So that's for thyroid. And someone might say, well, what's the big deal? Like, why not check it on everyone? And that's a fair question. It's probably not a huge deal to check it on everyone. But what ends up happening is there's definitely a percentage of people who have a mild thyroid abnormality, and even more who are sort of quote unquote borderline. And what ends up happening is when people get blood tested routinely for thyroid and these results come up, someone sees it. And usually what ends up happening is a lot more testing and treatments that may not be necessary. So getting put on thyroid supplements, you know, thyroid medication, and getting more blood tests every month, every 2 months. Now, it's not typically like a life and death thing, but it could be potentially cause side effects. It could be very annoying, give people a lot of anxiety that they now believe they have a condition or it's going to harm their baby, when in fact the data doesn't show that. So that's sort of the argument against testing everyone routinely. And that's sort of why the current recommendations are not to do it. There's certainly people who do, and you know, I don't begrudge them, that's fine. But that's sort of the main reason. So it's hard to say with your specifics without knowing all the results, but at least according to the best data we have, the miscarriage probably was not related to the thyroid. And treating the thyroid is not known to lower the chance of miscarriage in the next pregnancy. There might be some other benefits if you weren't feeling well or whatnot. Okay, again, that's just sort of as a general rule. For anemia, pretty much everybody does screen for anemia and iron deficiency early in pregnancy. Sort of, you know, part of the routine blood work that's done on anybody in the beginning of pregnancy is checking a complete blood count, which includes sort of their hemoglobin, hematocrit, which is an assessment of how high your blood levels are. And if they are low, typically the reason is iron deficiency, and that gets followed up, you know, check your iron and give iron. You know, there's other reasons your blood count could be low that's not iron deficiency, but that's the most common. So that typically is done. Again, also interestingly, having iron deficiency and having anemia, unless it is profound and someone's like ill, does not seem to impact the risk of fertility or miscarriage. There are issues maybe later in pregnancy, mostly related to the mother in terms of, you know, being weak, or maybe after delivery, if you lose blood, needing a blood transfusion, but it does not appear to affect the growth and development of the baby unless it's really profound, like some people with sickle cell anemia who have, you know, really, really low blood count. Sometimes it can affect the growth of the baby, but not the kind that's typically just picked up on someone without any symptoms. So again, it's hard to know it without knowing your specifics, but as far as we know, at least from all the data we have, I don't know if the iron deficiency was related to your miscarriage as well. And so in terms of your overarching question, I don't know if you would have had a healthy baby earlier had these things been screened earlier and treated earlier. Most of the data we have says that it would not have affected that. But again, we certainly don't know everything. And it's hard to know without knowing the specifics of your counts. But in general, for the population that has been studied and there's studies on them, it does not appear that it would have made a huge difference as far as we can tell. But that's very common in medicine, that we don't always know whether additional testing would have led to different outcomes or not. There's a lot of uncertainty in general in medicine. And obviously there's also situations where a study's reporting sort of the averages of a population, but it may not be relevant to a specific individual, right? Because all of us are different in many, many ways. And it is possible that in a given person, finding these and treating these could have helped them, but it's hard to know that for sure if we haven't seen it sort of on large scales in studies with larger populations. All right. Thank you all for these questions. Please keep them coming and we will keep doing the Mailbag Podcast. Hope you have a great day.
Thank you for listening to the Healthful Woman Podcast. To learn more about our podcast, please visit our website at www.healthfulwoman.com. That's H-E-A-L-T-H-F-U-L-W-O-M-A-N.com.
If you have any questions about this podcast or any other topic you would like us to address, please feel free to email us at hw@healthfulwoman.com. Have a great day. The information discussed in Healthful Woman is intended for educational uses only and does not replace medical care from your physician. Healthful Woman is meant to expand your knowledge of women's health and does not replace ongoing care from your regular physician or gynecologist. We encourage you to speak with your doctor about specific diagnoses and treatment options for an effective treatment plan.